Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour, looking at one topic in depth from a perspective generally not discussed by the mainstream or alternative medias. Today, the consequences of America's wars on our soldiers, their families, and our society. In the second part of our program, we'll be speaking with Dr. Ann Jones. She's a seasoned war journalist, investigative reporter. She's written extensively from the conflict zones in Afghanistan, South Asia, West Africa, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Her focus has been on the impact of America's wars upon civilians and the American soldiers who fight our wars. We'll go to her shortly. Before then, however, we're going to look at the way American veterans are treated in service and out. We're going to look at the best military in the world. Really? Not according to John LaForge. And the VA is broken. Death, medical mistreatment, claims, backlogs, and neglect at the Veterans Affairs hospitals and clinics. An exclusive from Jamie Reno, International Business Times. Before we show you what it's like to be a vet and needing help, I'm going to put this in historical perspective. At the conclusion of the first war in Iraq in 1991, I was asked to counsel some individuals who had fought there, others who had been in the theater but had not engaged in any military activities. They were part of the sport teams, but they all suffered from rare and unusual symptoms. These were young, healthy people. They were in their 20s. They were athletic, and yet they had rare lesions. They were fatigued, and within a year it became clear that they had been exposed to some biological or chemical weapons and other as yet unknown stimulants inside their system, pathogens. I began to focus my energies on this. I wrote several articles. I produced three different award-winning documentaries on the plight of the Gulf vets. I went with Gulf vets to Washington. We interviewed senators and House members, and they all agreed that there was a problem. And they all agreed that this American soldier had been let down, and they all agreed to do something. Nothing was done. And so it's been. In fact, as official policy, for nearly 20 years, Gulf War Syndrome simply was denied that it existed, even though there were over 49 papers published in peer-reviewed literature showing that it did exist. Why? Why do we have this attitude towards our veterans? And yet on the front end of the story, we're constantly reminded about how brave and heroic these vets are. Really? By what standard? We'll examine that, and that we give them everything they need to do our fighting. Do we? I don't think so. We'll examine it. But first, let's hear from a vet from a correctional institution giving a brief talk before a TED group. These are his words.
Blood, 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 red blood!
What's the spirit of the warrior?
Kill, kill, kill without mercy!
What are the two types of people in this world?
The quick and the dead!
What are you?
The quick!
What are they?
The dead!
Sergeant, let me hear your war cry!
Ah!
What you just saw was a small part of the training I received while I was in the United States Army. I joined just after September 11th. They train you to harness a deep inner rage. A hidden rage, a rage that most people don't even know they have. In combat, that rage can keep you alive, but at home, that rage can kill you. Let me back up a second and tell you why I joined the Army. Most of you can probably remember where you were on September 11th. I will remember for the rest of my life. I was working as a forklift operator, just out of high school. I'm driving around and everyone disappeared. I don't know where anybody is. So I head up to the front of the building, and everybody's around a small 13-inch TV. As I walk up, I watch the second plane hit the Twin Towers. I knew at that moment that I was going to join the military. Before I made it to Iraq, I spent about a year in Central America. It was beautiful. This is the upside to the Army. You get to see the world. I spent about a year bouncing around the jungles of Panama, Nicaragua, Honduras. I fell in love with the culture. I got to see and try new things. I even got to swim in the Atlantic and the Pacific in the same day without getting on an airplane. The good times didn't last, though. In 2004, my unit received orders to deploy to the Middle East in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. We were going to be stationed in Tikrit, Iraq. It's Saddam Hussein's hometown, right in the heart of the Sunni Triangle. About halfway through my tour, we received orders to go to Fallujah. At the time, the insurgents controlled the entire city of Fallujah, and we were sent in to recapture the city. I was a turret gunner hanging out of the top of a 50, hanging out of the top of a Humvee on a 50 cal. And I was going to be the eyes and ears of the convoy. The drive from Tikrit to Fallujah was only supposed to take about 10 hours, even with the slow military vehicles. But the enemy had other plans. On the way down, they started blowing up bridges and setting up ambushes along the way. We would redirect our path each time we'd come into a new contact. And after 36 hours, with nonstop combat, no sleep, and high stress, your mind starts to play tricks on you. I start seeing things that aren't there, start hearing things that aren't there, you start to lose control of your rage. At some point, the second night with no sleep, I must have fell asleep, dozed off, the cool air rocking me to sleep, because I awoke to total chaos, gunfire. I remember hearing the AK-47 rounds hitting the side of the Humvee just inches from my head, tink, 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 tink. And I woke up, fear washed over me. I remember the pink glow of RPGs shooting through the air in every direction. Total chaos, explosions all around me. I lit up the 50 cal. Thump, thump, thump. Thump, thump, thump. Thump, thump, thump. Moving from one target to the next. In the middle of all this chaos, I could hear somebody laughing. And I thought to myself, who could be laughing at a time like this? And then I realized it was me laughing. I felt like I was finally losing control of that rage they taught me to harness. Come time to leave Iraq, and they asked for volunteers to stay. They needed somebody to find and neutralize the IEDs that were killing so many people. It wasn't a decision that I took lightly, but if I didn't volunteer, they were going to pick people. And I wasn't married, I didn't have kids, and I didn't want them to pick somebody with a family. So I volunteered for a second tour. That second tour, we spent 3 or 4 vehicles to go out every day. We'd drive about 10 miles an hour down the road, barely moving. We'd look at the side of the road, try to find the IEDs, improvised explosive device, and we'd wait for the road to blow up on us. While in Iraq, I lost 7 of my best friends.
Sergeant! Attention! Right! Peace! Present! Halt!
Forgive me. My transition home was difficult, to say the least. I was paranoid. I carried a pistol on me at all times. I assessed the threat level of every person or place I came in contact with. Driving through my family's neighborhood, I drove in the middle of the street in fear that the side of the road was going to blow up and kill me. On the outside, I look like every other 21-year-old college student. I bought the newest clothes. I played beer pong, chased girls, rooted for the Buckeyes. But inside, there was something wrong. After a few months, my family and friends convinced me that there was something wrong and I needed some help. I went to the VA, walk-in mental health clinic, and I told them, "You guys got to help me. I'm going to hurt someone. I don't want to. I carry a pistol to protect myself, but I'm scared." They gave me a prescription for a sleep aid and sent me on my way and told me to come back in 6 months. I didn't make it 6 months. A few months later, I was out with some friends. We were drinking. We were having a good time. I'd been drinking every day to deal with my issues. It's hard to think of yourself as an alcoholic when you're playing beer pong, but you're drinking every day. You're an alcoholic. We're out. We're having some drinks, and an argument erupted over a girl. Someone pulled out a knife, and I snapped. I pulled out my pistol. The prosecutor said, "I moved through the room in a tactical manner, clearing the room, laid everybody on the ground. I took the knife from him, and I began beating him, and I beat him, and I beat him." A few days later, I got arrested for attempted murder and several other charges. Some I did, some I didn't do. When I went in for sentencing, my judge told me, "Mr. Chambers, your service is a double-edged sword. Your time in Iraq makes you a threat to society, and I have a civil obligation to lock you up. I received 10 years, and here I am today." Some of you that are familiar with the TEDx format are probably waiting on my call to action, but you just did it. Find a veteran and listen to his story. A lot of us just need somebody to talk to.
Sergeant, attention! Sarge, it's okay. You're home now, man. It's over. You're safe. Welcome home. Addie!
How many soldiers experience something similar to this? There are nearly 950,000 homeless vets in the United States. In the last year, I've met many of them, filmed them. You have possibly seen American veterans abandoned and betrayed. No matter where I find them, down in New Orleans, in a lower ward, under a bridge, in L.A., in the middle of the woods, out in Arizona, doesn't matter. They are all suffering. They feel excluded. They feel detached from the reality of the rest of society. They don't know how to cope. And the VA has abandoned them. The President of the United States has abandoned them. The entire military-industrial complex has abandoned them. And the American media has refused to give it the energy and emphasis it deserves, to put a face on it. It's only when you can sit with someone and look in their eyes and see how much they suffer. Yet walking down the street, you won't notice this person. The VA is broken, it is corrupted, and should be completely taken apart and put in its place, and another more holistic facility should emerge in its place. According to Jamie Reno, it is May 2008. 75-year-old Jim Workman, a retired Air Force colonel, entered an emergency room at a Department of Veterans Affairs Hospital in Biloxi, Mississippi. He was complaining of shortness of breath, coughing, and a fever. A chest x-ray was ordered, and the radiologist discovered 2-centimeter mass in his lung. He didn't tell Workman directly, but noted the finding and recommended an immediate follow-up in an electronically signed note sent to Workman's primary care doctor in the Veterans Administration. But that doctor never bothered to look at the note, nor the x-ray. 2 years later, Workman was diagnosed with lung cancer, and he died 2 years after that. "This should never have happened," Workman's widow, Sheila, told International Business Times in an exclusive interview. "Jim would have lived a lot longer if it weren't for the Veterans Administration. They dropped the ball. I miss my husband every day. Sheila sued the VA for failing to diagnose and treat her husband's cancer. She was awarded $250,000. Frighteningly, this story is not an anomaly. It is increasingly typical of the inadequate treatment veterans receive at VA hospitals and clinics. Korean War veteran Gary Wellingham, 80 years of age, went to the VA hospital in Dallas for what his family believed would be a short operation just to remove a small tumor from his neck. But the doctors accidentally clamped off his carotid artery and literally starved his brain of oxygen for 15 minutes. He had a massive stroke, was rendered paralyzed, and unable to eat or drink on his own. He died the following year. Wellingham's family was never informed about the ghastly mistake made by VA doctors. His daughter told the IBT Times, "I only found out after digging deep into the file. He suffered the rest of his life because we were not told the truth. We were never given the facts. If we were, then we wouldn't have proved subsequent surgeries." One presidential administration after another has vowed to fix the embattled VA, which employs more than 300,000 men and women and is the second largest department in the federal government after the Pentagon. President Obama has even increased the VA's annual budget to an all-time high of $150 billion. But VA's healthcare system continues to worsen in more and more dangerous ways, severely underserving the nearly 7 million veterans who rely on the network for care every year. In just the past year, we've learned about preventable deaths of military veterans at VA facilities across the nation, as well as the spread of infectious diseases at these hospitals and clinics. In addition, there is evidence of bonuses awarded to executives at troubled VA hospitals and a lengthy ongoing disability claims backlog. Meanwhile, frustrated lawmakers hold hearings on VA shortcomings, adopt new rules in hopes of turning the VA around, and even create websites highlighting VA's many problems, all to no avail. Quote, "It's become apparent to me and many others that there is a culture of complacency among the agency's middle management." So says Jeffrey Miller, Republican of Florida, chair of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. "These middle-level managers know that as federal employees, there's a good chance they'll have their ways and nothing can be done about it. They're evidently willing just to wait out those of us who are trying to change things, and unfortunately the consequences are as serious as life and death for our veterans." Relations between the VA and Congress have deteriorated in recent months, with many lawmakers voicing displeasure over VA's unwillingness to release reports and statistics about the agency's performance. Congress has more than 111 pending requests to VA for answers on such things as, where are you spending your money? What are the standards for medical and mental health care? Of the many preventable deaths at VA hospitals recently, three occurred in Memphis. One of the patients died after being given a drug despite a documented allergy to that medication. Another vet died from a lethal dose of a painkiller. A third died because the staff did not give the patient the proper medication. And last week, CNN reported that at a VA medical center in Columbia, South Carolina, six veterans waiting months for basic gastrointestinal procedures, such as colonoscopy, died because their cancers weren't caught in time. There were also five avoidable deaths in Pittsburgh and four in Atlanta. Quote, "As we dig through the medical centers, we find that a number of deaths could have easily been prevented. It's inexcusable." And beyond the many deadly medical errors at VA facilities and unhealthy sanitary conditions, that's another scourge. For example, in St. Louis, more than 1,800 patients at one VA hospital may have been exposed to HIV and hepatitis as a result of contaminated dental equipment, according to a posting on an accountability website. A separate report on the website claims that for nearly 18 years, unsanitary practices at Dayton VA Medical Center potentially exposed hundreds of patients to hepatitis B and hepatitis C. And then you have the debacle of disability claims. VA's disability claims backlog is perhaps even more troubling because it affects hundreds of thousands of veterans. According to the VA's Monday morning workload report, the backlog of new and reopened disability claims is 711,000. That is a tremendous amount of people, and they're not getting seen in a timely manner. How long does it take from the time you have a problem as a veteran to get it treated and helped? They're waiting 5 years or longer for their claims to be heard. That's 5 years. Could you imagine that there is no accountability? No one is fired? No one is reprimanded? And yet, this is what our veterans are faced with. Yet this is not told to them going into the armed forces. That brings up another issue. I have counseled many veterans who are on a whole load of psychiatric medications, and yet they presented no mental health disorders. This is from Reuters, Allison Bond Kotru. Many vets given psychiatric drugs without diagnosis. Nearly one-third of U.S. veterans who are given psychiatric medications by their doctors do not have a diagnosed mental health problem. Older vets between 65 and 85 were the ones most commonly prescribed psychotropic drugs without any formal diagnosis and were least likely to be receiving mental health treatment. That's according to the American Journal of Geriatric Psychiatry. The findings are important because such drugs can pose very serious health risks. Psychiatric medications can save lives, they say, but they can also harm them. So says psychiatrist at Yale School of Medicine, lead author of the study. Quote, "My work aims to ensure that older adults receive the right medicine for the right diagnosis in the safest way possible." Well, there's 1.85 million veterans in the study filled prescriptions during just 1 year and for at least one psychiatric medication. And information about the patients and their health issues were pulled from their medical records. Patients older than 65 were prescribed psychiatric medications without a diagnosis 44% more often than were patients in their 40s. So my question is this. You go to see a doctor. You're having problems, health problems, and the doctor gives you a psychiatric drug. Yet you're not there because of something happening on an emotional level. That's how bad the medical profession has been treating the vets. But that's only one example. This is from CBS News. Veterans, quote, by the tens of thousands have come home from Iraq and Afghanistan with injuries suffered on the battlefield. Many of them seek treatment at Veterans Affairs hospitals. Now, a CBS News investigation has found that some veterans are dying of accidental overdoses of narcotic painkillers at a much higher rate than the general population. And some VA doctors are speaking out. Five tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan left 35-year-old Army Specialist Scott McDonald with chronic back pain. His wife, Heather, said over the course of a year, VA doctors in Columbus, Ohio, prescribed him 8 pain and psychiatric medications. Quote, it just got out of control. They just started giving him pill after pill, prescription after prescription, and he'd come home with all brand new medications at higher milligrams. Then a VA doctor added a 9th pill, a narcotic called Percocet. Later that evening, Heather came home from work and found Scott disoriented on the couch. And I asked him, you didn't by chance, by accident, take too many pills, did you? And he's like, no, I did what they told me. I took what they told me to take, Heather. I popped a pillow over his head. And to rest, But that's how I found him the next day, exactly like that. Dead. McDonald wasn't breathing. The coroner's report ruled his death accidental. He had been over-medicated, and he died from a combined effects of five of his medications. Quote, there's an overuse of narcotics, says Dr. Phyllis Hollenbeck, a physician at the VA Medical Center in Jackson, Mississippi. It's the first reflex for pain. Hollenbeck raised her concerns with the federal government about the VA's practices about prescribing narcotics. She says the people in charge, we want you to sign off on narcotic prescriptions on patients you don't see. I was absolutely stunned. I knew immediately it was illegal. It works on the surface. It keeps the veterans happy. They don't complain. They're not coming in as often as if they had pain medicine. And the people in charge don't care if it's done right. CBS News obtained VA data through a records request which showed the number of prescriptions written by VA doctors and nurse practitioners during the past 11 years. The number of patients treated by VA is up 29%. The narcotics prescriptions are up 259%. A dozen VA physicians who've worked at 15 VA medical centers told us they felt pressured by administrators to prescribe narcotics and that patients are not being properly monitored. Quote, I have seen people that have not had an exam of that body part and they're complaining of pain in for 2 years. It's easier to write a prescription for narcotics and just move along, get to the next patient. We're letting people come in and prescribing massive doses of narcotics, and they are also on the drugs for mental health problems. By giving those kinds of quantities of pills, one might assume that that requires a rather close eye being kept on the patient. Quote, you would think so, but it isn't that the case. We gathered data from five of the states with the most veterans. We found that they're dying of accidental narcotic overdoses, 33% higher than non-veterans. Now, of course, they're not also at this point acknowledging how many veterans have committed suicide, but it's massive, massive amount are committing suicide. This is just one brief report, over-medication of veterans and suicide. Before dawn, a government van picked up paratrooper Jeffrey Weingunner for the five-hour drive to a Department of Veterans Affairs hospital in southern Oregon. His orders? Detox from a brutal addiction to painkillers. He had only the clothes on his back, his watch, and a MP3 player and a two-page pain contract the Army made him sign, a promise to get clean. But instead of keeping him away from his vice, medical records show the VA hospital in Roseburg kept him so doped up that he could barely stay awake. Then the VA released him for the weekend with a cocktail of 19 different prescription medications, including 12 tablets of a highly addictive oxycodone. 3 hours later, he was dead of a drug overdose, slumped in a heap in front of his room at the Sleep-In Motel. Quote, as a parent, you want to know how this happened to your child. You send your child to a hospital to get well, not to die. That's the opening of Aaron Glantz's latest report for the Center for Investigative Reporting. The topic of VA's over-reliance on prescription painkillers is the topic of a hearing scheduled for this Thursday. This is a sweeping program, and it has a huge impact. Until recently, the VA did very little to track suicides. That happened only because Senator Patty Murray relentlessly pursued the VA to get them to start tracking suicides. If they had done their job on their own, or if they had immediately responded to Murray's request, there might have been a sense of whether the high rate of veteran suicides was influenced in any way by prescription drugs. This is one veteran's experience. Morphine, metoprolol, prozazin, ibuprofen, diazepam, and a dozen others For Boone Cutler, this was a combat cocktail. That's just 1 month's worth of the medications he was given at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington while being treated for traumatic brain injury after a mortar attack in Sartre City in Iraq in 2005. Quote, I'll tell you, at one point in time, I was on every drug that killed Anna Nicole Smith, plus some, Cutter said, who was an Army sergeant at the time of the attack. Meanwhile, Keith Rogers of the Las Vegas Review-Journal reports, Concerned Veterans for America will launch a nationwide bus tour from Las Vegas to heighten awareness about the Department of Veterans Affairs foot dragging and its efforts to reduce a staggering backlog of 500,000 benefit claims. And so we have to ask the question, why as a nation can we not take an honest look at the million injured, the $3 trillion it's going to cost us to help them, the 900,000 homeless vets. So you're talking about nearly 2 million vets that are in serious need of help. The high level of suicide, acts of violence. More veterans are killing themselves each day than are dying in combat zones around the world. And yet, we can't grab this and look at it. If you ask the Pentagon, if you have other agencies, they feign ignorance and they'll pass you off to someone else. Would they get some satisfaction by some of the people in the Pentagon? Probably not. The Pentagon seems to have an aversion to being responsible for any of the mistakes they make. But they do take credit when it comes to approving record sales of advanced arms to countries at war. According to Joe Erickson of Mint Press, selling weapons used to be a cutthroat business with a no-question-asked policy. It has led in the past to the selling of weapons to support African conflicts, leaving Angola, Somalia, Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo awash with AK-47 semi-automatic rifles and fatal allows. Today's high-tech weapons manufacturers are enjoying record sales. The State Department's military assistance report stated that it approved $44 billion in arms shipments to 173 nations in the last fiscal year. One of the more controversial is the Defense Department's plans to sell Saudi Arabia $6.8 billion and the United Arab Emirates $4 billion advanced weaponry, including air-launched cruise missiles and precision munitions. The trouble is, as anyone asked, where these weapons will ultimately end up. Boeing and Raytheon sent a message of support from the Obama administration for setting up the deal with these two close allies in the Middle East. This historic deal will be the first U.S. sales of the new Raytheon and Boeing weapons that can be launched at a distance from Saudi with F-15 and United Arab Emirates with F-16 fighters. That's just a part of the shopping list. So here we have the U.S. military making some of the most sophisticated weapons in the world, selling them by the tens of billions of dollars a year, and yet it can't find 17,000 homeless veterans without food, without water, without electricity, without sanitation, without housing, living in the woods in Central Florida. I did. Why can't they? They can't find 950,000 who are homeless? No. They can't speed up a 5-year waiting list to get treated? No. So you see, we have examples of extreme. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go to my guest now. Again, let me introduce my guest in Norway. Dr. Ann Jones is a seasoned war journalist, investigative reporter. She has authored 8 books. She has reported from conflict zones in Afghanistan, South Asia, West Africa. Her focus has been on the impact of America's wars upon civilians and the American soldiers who fight our wars. Her most recent book is They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Returned from American Wars, The Untold Story. She was supported by a fellowship from Harvard University. And she paints a horrid picture. picture of the dead, wounded, mutilated, the brain damaged, the drug addicted, the suicidal casualties within our military ranks and its effect on families and loved ones. Nice to have you with us today, Ann.
Thank you.
It was a year ago that I took my camera crew and we went into an area near Titusville, Florida. That's very close to Cape Canaveral. I was told that I would find some homeless soldiers there, and I did. I just wasn't expecting 16,000. That's how many are residents in the central area of Florida. What surprised me was that they live in little groups, sometimes four or five, sometimes as many as 100. Their living conditions are something the average American would not expect. They have no running water, electricity, they have no food, medical attention, they have no money, and some only have small pup tents, some don't have any tents. I came across a young man in his late 20s who was sleeping, curled up in a fetal position in a T-shirt, and yet it was in February, and it was 42 degrees, and it was cold. And I spent several days filming them and getting their stories. And what was remarkable is across the board, all of these people wanted to get help, were open to help for their conditions, and were given no help by the Veterans Administration, the Defense Department. And I said, well, what do you think now of Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity and the people who say are brave soldiers, you know, we defend them and they're heroes? And one of the guys on camera said, you know, what does this look like? He said, this is the help they give us. Look at us. We have nothing. One guy standing beside him said, I went to war and I had a home in Pittsburgh with a swimming pool in the backyard. I'm a welder. I was making good money. And I went to fight for my country. What has my country done for me? And they showed me various problems they had, psychological and physical. And I sent a copy of the multi-award-winning documentary to every television radio station in the United States that did a talk program. Over 7,000 members of the American media at all levels. Not a single person would even respond to the documentary, let alone want to know the plight of these people. And a lot of them are alcoholics. Almost all suffer from some form of post-traumatic stress conditions. They have been denied, and the film is called Forgotten and Betrayed, Our American Veterans. Take us through now what it means when the American public and the American media are in denial of the actual cost of a conflict because they don't have to see it up front, both to the soldiers but also to the people in the lands that we invade. Take us on this journey, if you would, please.
Well, I think it goes beyond even being in denial. There is a prescribed narrative that we're all trained to believe. You know, our soldiers undergo intensive basic training, and our citizenry undergoes basic training in being a militarized nation that makes war round the clock. And we're taught to think that that's a heroic enterprise and that we're doing good in the world and that we're also protecting our freedoms here at home from a world full of enemies who are out to get us. That's the narrative we're all led to believe. And so we don't look very much at the cost to the people whose lands we invade, all the thousands upon thousands of dead Iraqis and dead Afghans as a result of this war, and the ongoing violence in both of those countries, even after the Iraq war is supposedly over. We don't look at that, and we don't even look at what happens to our own soldiers and how the death and injury of our own soldiers impacts every citizen in this country. Our military has invested greatly in its medical prowess. So military medicine has an extraordinarily good record now of being able to save lives. So that the result of that is Americans are led to believe that relatively few of our soldiers are dying in these wars, something well over 6,000 now. But that seems a small number in comparison to the number of enemy dead and particularly the number of civilian dead. But we don't hear reports about the attendant deaths of mercenary contractors, more than 3,000 of those, and we certainly don't hear about the terrible injuries that are done to our soldiers. Well over 100,000 now, and that's probably a conservative estimate, of soldiers who have been catastrophically injured, mutilated. We know that some of the signatures of these wars are amputations, double, triple, quadruple amputations, amputation of genitalia in our male soldiers, brain damage, horrible results of burns and other kinds of injuries. This goes on day in, day out, but, you know, we get the story only of those triumphant, courageous veterans who have lost legs in these wars and now have been fitted with prosthetic devices and are going out hiking or playing softball. And isn't that wonderful? And so this is a great thing that soldiers have lost their legs for the country, and it's really fairly simple. They just get a new pair. When I embedded with the military at a forward operating base in Afghanistan to report on women soldiers, I discovered how many of our male soldiers as well were being critically injured in battle, and then they would be, or simply by explosions, and then they would be carried off in a medevac helicopter, and that would be the end of the story. So it took me a year to get permission from the military to go along on those medevac journeys and see what actually happens from the point when a soldier is injured. And I think one of the most startling things to me was the catastrophic tale, damage that was done not just to the soldiers, but to the doctors and nurses and other medical personnel who have to attend to them because of the extreme nature of the wounds and injuries that they're required to treat. And I describe that process in the book, following the injured from the field in Afghanistan to Bagram Base Hospital, and then on to the next higher level of traumatic care at Landstuhl Medical Center in Germany, and then to the top levels of traumatic care in the United States at Walter Reed and Bethesda. And I describe the whole process that these soldiers are put through and then the rehabilitation process from their injuries, which may require them to spend a year, 2 years, even more in hospital rehabilitation facilities just to get in shape to go home where probably their families are going to have to care for them for the rest of their lives. And all of this, of course, is paid for by the rest of us taxpayers to the tune of billions of dollars. It's estimated that by the time these payments are completed, maybe 40 or 50 years from now, by mid-century at least, we will have paid well over $1 trillion in disability and care payments for the veterans of these two wars. Mm-hmm. So it cost them, it cost their caregivers, their professional caregivers, their family caregivers. It impacts their communities who are involved in caring for them, and it impacts the entire country, which is paying the cost in many ways, for these pointless wars into which these soldiers were flung.
Appreciate that overview, Anne. To follow up on what you just mentioned, I've interviewed Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, and the average American sitting at their television watching mainstream talking parrots and amoral so-called experts like John Bolton and the other neocons are given the perception that our wars are in distant lands and hence not in view, and what happens over there really has no impact upon us. Yet a recent Forge article says that over 1 million U.S. soldiers have been wounded in the Afghanistan and Iraqi wars. That is, aside from the thousands that you mentioned, 6,000 killed, 3,000 mercenaries or private contractors, the cost to taxpayers for keeping each soldier in Afghanistan is now $2.1 million per soldier. And it is costing Americans $50 million to kill a single Taliban warrior. So if you kill 20 Taliban fighters in a single drone strike, it is a cost of $1 billion to accomplish that. And that is only the human cost of war on our soldiers in the U.S. economy, and that it'll cost us over $6 trillion, according to Stiglitz. And I think that that is just completely not on anyone's mindset. Now, to follow up, this is a broad question because every soldier will have his own individual experience he brings back with him or her after serving in the fields and mountains of Afghanistan and Iraq. But since you have interviewed numerous soldiers, if you were to try to encapsulate the changes of the average foot soldier's view about himself and our government in the worldview, what would be its major defining features?
Well, that's a very big question, and of course there is a diversity of opinion among the soldiers, but I think among the most damaging things that they experience is a sense of having been betrayed. Sometimes that's a very direct betrayal by officers who send them into situations that they themselves can see are useless, and in which their buddies are blown up by explosive devices. For example, in Afghanistan, you know, General Petraeus developed this notion that we needed to return to the counterinsurgency tactics that worked so notoriously badly in Vietnam, and soldiers were ordered to dismount from their their armored vehicles and walk about in land that's laced not only with IEDs by the Taliban, but still laced with landmines left over from the Soviet war. So soldiers are cast into situations that they understand, that makes them understand that the military doesn't really give isn't very greatly concerned for their welfare and their survival as it should be. And then you have those who are commanded in military service to do things that betray their own principles. For example, I tell the story, a fairly, I'm sorry to say, typical story in the book of a soldier who came home from the invasion of Iraq, seemed to be all right, then started to noticeably deteriorate and told his family he was nothing but a murderer. And as his family struggled to get help for him from the VA, the story gradually emerged that he had been in charge of a couple of Iraqi prisoners and was ordered by his commanding officer to shoot them. And under that direct order, he apparently did that. and could not live with it. And although his family deeply loved him and did their utmost to get help that he needed, he succeeded after about a year in killing himself, in taking his own life. And as we know, the veterans now are committing suicide at the rate of more than 20 a day. Far more veterans have died by their own hand than were killed in combat. And in many cases, that is simply because, having been betrayed by their commanders and by their country, really, that sent them into this and takes no responsibility for it, and having themselves betrayed their own principles, they can't live with it anymore. Now, I have to say, on the other hand, there are soldiers who really get into fighting the war. And I quote some of them in my book, who say, in language that I can't repeat over the radio, that they enjoy killing people. They really enjoy blowing things up. They enjoy destroying people's houses. And it's really a lot of fun, and they can't wait to do more of it. And many of the such soldiers, I'm sorry to say, are drawn from the ranks of already convicted criminals in this country, because the Army so desperately needs cannon fodder. And many of them then leave the service, the uniformed services, and go on to be mercenary contractors, many of them aligned with special forces and all kinds of secret operations that the American public knows nothing about. So war produces a great variety of responses in the people who are called upon to fight it, or even in the lives of those who staff the bases without necessarily being involved in combat at all. But it's my view, and certainly substantiated by all those I spoke to in the course of this war, including those whose duty it is to save the lives of others, the medical personnel. There is no one who comes home from these wars without having undergone a significant change. And if I could just mention one other important group, I ran into many in the military who came home changed because they said that being in Iraq and in Afghanistan and other places where the U.S. is carrying out military operations in the world, Yemen, Somalia, and so on, they had seen how other people in the world live, and they had seen the price that people pay for Americans to continue to enjoy the American way of life. And they could not return to civilian life and be content with that, knowing what they know about what it costs others in the world for us to ignore the conditions in which they live. And increasingly, for us to ignore the conditions in which large numbers of our own population, including homeless veterans, live.
What is your view for the reasons why our government and media conceal the actual effect of these wars on our military service people and instead continue to promote a phantasmagoria, a patriotism, worship, and heroism being performed by our troops?
Another very complicated question. But I think, you know, Americans are generally information deprived. We are used to having talking heads, self-appointed experts in our media telling us what to think. And most of those self-appointed experts are the ones who supported going into these wars in the first place, were wrong in every prediction they made about the outcome of these wars, and yet are still regarded as experts on military matters. So those people, we can say, are deliberately misleading the public to uphold their own opinions, which have been demonstrated to be wrong and demonstrated at the expense of a great many American and foreign lives, civilian lives. So we have them, and then we have the fact that our media are corporate owned. The bottom line is important to the corporations that own the media, and so there is a kind of party line that is broadcast, and a lot of the information in our media comes not from the experience of journalists who go to these wars and report on what they see, but comes from official sources. The great majority of the information that Americans get through the media comes from official sources in Washington, including the Pentagon. And they tell us what they want us to know, and many, I would say most, of the news media simply parrots that back. And, of course, those of us who do go and see what's going on and try to report on it, we are not in great demand with the mainstream media. We have to find our way of trying to get the news out by writing books, by using the internet, by communicating through programs such as yours to an audience.
Well, Dr. Jones, thank you very much. I'm sorry, but we're out of time. Major contribution you have made with your newest work, and that is They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Returned from America's Wars. My guest, Dr. Ann Jones. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.